Welcome back to the program. Originally conceived in September of 1969 as a nationwide environmental teach-in, the first Earth Day was a call to action that inspired thousands of events across the country. Becoming larger than the biggest civil rights and anti-war demonstrations of the 60s, roughly 1,500 colleges and 10,000 schools held teach-in, activities that took place in hundreds of churches and temples, in city parks, in front of commercial and government buildings. It created a lasting eco-infrastructure, and that first Earth Day in 1970 would give rise to the first green generation. We're going to talk about that remarkable achievement today with my guest, Adam Rome. Adam Rome teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. He's an environmental historian. His previous book was The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism. And it is my pleasure to welcome Adam Rome here to talk about The Genius of Earth Day, how a 1970s teach-in unexpectedly made the first green generation. Adam Rome, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. When events are a great success, or when anything is a great success, there's always so many people that want to take credit for it. Who really deserves the credit for coming up with the idea of Earth Day?
It's funny that you ask that, because if you look on the web, there really literally are half a dozen people that say they were the founders of Earth Day, or they were the first to use that phrase. But there's no doubt that the idea started with U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. He had been trying, since he came to the Senate in 1963, to make environmental issues a national priority, and he had struck out again and again. He tried to get the president to do something, to take a conservation tour of the country, which John Kennedy did, but it didn't work. He tried to get Congress to pass major legislation, and Congress just didn't listen to him. And finally, in 1969, he got inspired by a tactic that had been used by the anti-Vietnam War movement, the teach-in, which was a kind of politicized educational event outside of classes. And he thought young people might be able to do what the president and Congress had failed to do, and he was right. His call for people to organize environmental teach-ins succeeded far beyond anything that he dreamed, and he gets the credit.
And that initial event required some pretty serious organizational effort. Talk a little bit about that.
Nelson, I think part of his genius was that he realized he couldn't make the teach-in his own thing, that he had to let go and let others take ownership of it. His own staff was very involved early on and was soon overwhelmed with calls from people wanting to do something, and he hired a group of 20-something activists who had all been involved in the civil rights or anti-war or other causes of the 60s to help. But ultimately, tens of thousands of people all across the country became the local organizers of these thousands of Earth Day events. And they were the ones who really made it happen. And for many of them, it was a transformative experience. They worked on it for 3 or 4 months. Sometimes, as one told me, it was just a 3-month adrenaline high, constantly challenged to figure out what kind of thing was this going to be. There had never been an Earth Day before. And all the thinking through of what to do and why and what even counted as an environmental issue allowed some of these people, was really empowering for the local organizers. I think that was the secret, ultimately, of the long-lasting legacy of Earth Day, that so many people came out of the event empowered and wanted to do more.
Certainly Gaylord Nelson wanted to bring attention to these issues, but even he couldn't have imagined that it would strike the kind of chord that it did, that it would generate the kind of response that it did.
Absolutely. I mean, he would have been happy if 50 colleges had done something. And part of that was there really was no environmental movement before Earth Day. There had been a lot of concern about a variety of different issues, from pesticides to air and water pollution to suburban sprawl to garbage piling up, even litter. But the people that worked on those issues were fragmented. They weren't part of any kind of common cause. And one of the miracles of Earth Day was that it gave rise to the idea that there was, in fact, an environmental movement. That phrase was never used before the run-up to Earth Day. it literally brought all these people who had been working separately together. They often appeared on the same stages, in the same panels, in the same events. And it also gave people the idea that all these separate problems really were part of one huge problem, what people started to call the environmental crisis. And I think Nelson was just amazed by the reaction. He had a newsletter. I reproduce the front page of it after Earth Day, and it just says, "Mass Movement Begins." That's the headline. And he was a very modest guy. He didn't really take credit for that. But he really did help to launch something new.
What's so interesting is thinking about it in a contemporary context, and that's what's hard kind of to get your head around, because there wasn't the kind of interconnectivity that we have today, and this really became the flashpoint for connecting all of these people. It wasn't like they could all get on Facebook.
Right. Oh, it's so amazing. I mean, there wasn't even Xeroxing. People still had mimeograph machines, and there was no computers, there was no internet. People still had to have Rolodexes in order to keep track. That was part of what the young 20-somethings did, was just literally compile this massive Rolodex of all the local Earth Day organizers, which they then used later to lobby Congress on a variety of bills. So it was all done face-to-face. It was all do-it-yourself. That's one reason it took so long to organize. But I think the time that these people spent organizing and all that face time really allowed it to sink in, to really become a profound experience for so many people who were involved.
Beyond Senator Nelson, talk about who some of the other principals were in this effort.
The most famous, and the New York Times on Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970, made him the person of the day, was Dennis Hayes, who was one of the 20-somethings that Nelson hired. And he was just a law and government student at Harvard, and he'd had a very roundabout career. He'd traveled a lot. He'd taken a lot of time off before finally finishing college, and he'd had some activist experience, but he'd never really worked on environmental issues before. And that was common for a lot of the organizers, I think that was part of what Earth Day made it so successful, was that it really drew in people who didn't think of themselves as environmental activists, but some of them were nature lovers, some of them were biologists, but many of them just thought this was a good cause. Some of them thought it was a relatively risk-free cause. They weren't going to get arrested or tick off their parents. But it drew all kinds of people, high schoolers, college folks, housewives, young professionals who were looking to do something more exciting than banking or accounting, and many of them went on to incredible careers. They created environmental careers. There really was no path yet for people interested in these issues. The people who were inspired by Earth, they had to then make their own way.
And Dennis Hayes, probably more than anybody else, gets credit for being the first organizer of Earth Day.
He does, and. But as I say, I really think that the local organizers are the unsung folks, and none of them are famous, although many of them I profile in the book. I end the book with three local organizers whose lives were changed by Earth Day. One of them, Dorothy Bradley, was 23 years old. She had really distrusted politics, but on the night of Earth Day, after the successful event in Bozeman, Montana, a couple people, a state senator and a League of Women Voters official, said, "Why don't you run for the legislature?" And she had to decide instantly. The filing deadline was the next day, and she had to drive to the state capitol in order to do it. And she did. And as the state senator said to her, "You got three strikes against you. You're young, you're a woman in a man's field, and you're a Democrat in a Republican county." But she won, and she ended up serving many terms in the legislature and doing critical things to help deal with a coal mining boom, very much like fracking today, that mm-hmm. she worried would change the whole state, and she wanted people to take time to think about it. I profile several other people whose stories I think are just as amazing, and they're not household names, but they all really made history.
Was there any pushback to the idea and the energy that Earth Day was consuming simply because in the minds of some it wasn't as important as civil rights or Vietnam?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great question. And there were people on the left who were worried that this would distract folks from those causes in particular, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-poverty movement, even the just beginning women's liberation movement. And the young organizers Nelson hired were very conscious of that. They did a lot to try to use their forum, their bully pulpit, to argue that Earth Day wasn't a cop-out, it wasn't going to be a distraction, it was part of a broader movement. But there was also some pushback on the right. There were some conservatives, although not as many as you would think from today's environment, who thought it was a communist plot. But Earth Day attracted also conservatives and radicals, as well as people who were in middle of the road or thought of themselves as non-ideological. The need was so obvious. I mean, our air was so polluted, our waters were so polluted, you couldn't swim in them or fish in them. There were so many other obvious problems, and people didn't have to be sold on the idea that there were problems. What they needed was a sense that there was a political will to do something about it. And also recognizing that there wasn't going to be a quick fix, that the problems were going to take considerable effort over time to solve. And I think that's why Earth Day was critical, because it gave a long-term boost as well as a short-term boost to the movement.
How did the Nixon administration respond to it?
That's another great question. The Nixon administration was keenly aware that this was a popular issue. They were expecting to face in 1972 a Democrat with very strong environmentalist credentials, Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine. And they knew that they had to have a good environmental record. They decided not to make a big deal out of Earth Day itself because it was so identified with a Democratic senator, although Nelson had also got a Republican congressman to co-sponsor the event. But they did a lot of other things early that year because of Earth Day to really show that they cared. Although Nixon personally really didn't care about environmental stuff, he was much more interested in foreign policy, he had a lot of very young people on his staff who were knowledgeable and dedicated. Nixon was the one who created the Environmental Protection Agency. Nixon signed all the pioneering environmental legislation, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. So it was crucial to have a Republican president who recognized that, although he wasn't going to go about it in exactly the same way as the Democrats, he had to take action on these issues.
In many ways, much of the praise that Nixon gets for his environmental action was simply because, as you said, he really didn't care and he thought it was something he could do to pacify Democrats without them interfering with the things that he really did care about.
Well, also, back then, there were liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. All throughout a lot of states that we now think of as pure Democratic states, in the Northeast, in California, there were a lot of liberal Republicans. And so he also had to keep the liberals in his own party happy, to show them that he was taking seriously these issues and that he would use the powers of government to do what he could, even while trying to keep government smaller maybe than the Democrats wanted or to keep taxes lower. So I think the pressure came from a lot of places. Even Ronald Reagan in 1970, he was governor of California. He devoted a third of his State of the State address in 1970 to environmental issues, and his state was one of the leading states in trying to deal at the state level with environmental problems. Even though he changed his mind by a decade later, he was trying to undercut a lot of the environmental legislation of the 70s. Back in 70, he understood that this was important.
Was there a specific template that Hayes and Nelson's office had laid out for these events? Was there a certain similarity in the way they unfolded?
No, I think that was, again, I think part of Nelson's genius was he actually got advice. He it was a very odd thing for a 50-something senator, a pillar of the establishment, to try to organize teach-ins, borrowing this radical tactic from the anti-war movement. And he asked advice from a Democratic politico who had worked with both John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, but had also been a University of California regent. And that person, Fred Dutton, advised him to make a very top-down event, and Nelson was shrewd enough to reject that. He didn't try to dictate what Earth Day would be. So every local organizer, whether they were in Birmingham, Alabama, which ended up focusing on air pollution, or Fairbanks, Alaska, where they focused on the proposed Alaska oil pipeline, or, you know, University of Wisconsin, where their theme was lifestyle on trial, every local organizing group had to figure out for itself what kind of event to have and what tone, what purposes. So the event had some common features. They all involved a lot of speeches. By my estimate, at least 35,000 people spoke on Earth Day, and that was astonishing. No one knew that that many people had something to say. Most of them were first-time speakers on the subject. There were only a handful of environmental experts. But the exact nature of the Earth Day varied from place to place and region to region. And I think that, again, allowed Earth Day to be much more powerful. It seems counterintuitive to the way we think often about these issues. It wasn't unified. It wasn't controlled. But that actually was its power. It allowed Nelson to tap the creativity and the energy of thousands and thousands of people at the grassroots.
Who were some of the more powerful and persuasive speakers?
I think I can say this on the radio. One was a young environmental lawyer, one of the pioneers in the field, a guy named Victor Iannacone, whose speech, which he gave three or four times, he flew from one place to another, was called Sue the Bastards. Mm-hmm. And that was a real rallying cry. There was an environmental economist who was then at the University of Colorado, Kenneth Boulding, and he really raised questions about the gross national product, whether or not we had a true and accurate measure of how well the economy was doing, whether it was really providing the health and beauty and permanence that we needed from an economy. Stephanie Mills was a rock star. She was 1 year out of college, and she had made a reputation by, at her commencement, saying that because she was so worried about the future, she wasn't going to have kids, and that shocked people. And she spoke on Earth Day, and I profile her in the book as well. And her talk was about population, but it was also about how much we consume and about whether women needed more rights if we were going to get environmental issues under control. It was really fascinating stuff. So those would be three examples.
Was there a sense of this being what we would consider today, maybe a different word at the time, what we would consider today elitist, that it didn't filter down to the broader population?
I don't think so at all. I mean, millions and millions of people participated. It was by far the biggest demonstration, not just of the 60s generation, but of American history up to that point. There were some groups that participated more than others. A lot of the Earth Day organizers, for example, tried very hard to involve African Americans, but a lot of African Americans felt that even though they understood that they lived in polluted surroundings more often than affluent whites, they had other issues, prejudice, poverty in the ghetto, and so they didn't get involved as much as others. There's several groups like that, but there was no group that didn't get involved at all. The two black mayors, there only were two in 1970, in Gary, Indiana, and Cleveland, Ohio. Both of them were very involved on Earth Day, and in Cleveland, it was a member of the mayor's staff who organized what was called Crisis in the Environment Week. There were working class people. Philadelphia, the wife of a fireman in South Philly, suggested to the organizers that they have an unscenic bus tour that would go through some of the most polluted industrial wastelands and neighborhoods of Philly, which they did. And, you know, she hadn't gone to college. She wasn't affluent. So Earth Day brought in lots and lots of people. Labor unions, some of them were very involved. The United Auto Workers was hugely involved. So it was part of the strength of it was that it did bring lots of folks together who might not have been able to work together on anything else.
Did some of the other groups and some of the other activists of the day, whether it was women's issues or anti-war or anything else, did they look at this and learn something from, in fact, the way this was organized?
Oh, I love that question. I think the answer is no. I think they still could learn something now from how Earth Day was organized. I think one of the reasons that they might not have learned it was the media missed the real story. The media, the national media at least, gave tremendous coverage to Earth Day, but they treated Earth Day as just a 60s-style demonstration. They focused on a lot of street theater and other symbolic gestures, people wearing gas masks, they didn't really see that it was an educational event. They didn't get into the nitty-gritty to see who was involved and what people were saying and how people reacted to what people were saying. So I think that they depicted Earth Day as just one more of these fairly familiar by then big demonstrations. It was bigger than the others. It was about a new issue. But they didn't see that it was also fundamentally different in how it was organized. The biggest civil rights demonstration of the 60s was totally top-down. Six groups plus the Kennedy administration organized it. The biggest anti-war demonstration was the other way around. It was totally bottom-up. The coordinators were not powerful people. They weren't part of any big organization. The genius of Earth Day, which I don't think people appreciated at the time, was to combine the power of Washington, the power of a senator, with the creativity and the energy of the grassroots, and that's an unbeatable combination.
When did it become clear that this Earth Day, in all of its success of that day, was going to have a lasting impact, both in terms of it continuing and also in terms of it creating this environmental infrastructure?
On the day itself, a lot happened to suggest that this was a powerful thing. Several governors created environmental protection agencies that day for their state. Two legislatures passed environmental bills of rights. Congress shut down for the day because two-thirds of its members were speaking around the country. I think the media gave it unprecedented attention. So I think even the day after, it was clear that this was already having some powerful effects. Even after it was off the front page, in other ways, you could see within a few months that it was going to have some powerful, long-lived effects. In August 1970, only 4 months after Earth Day, editor and publisher, the premier magazine of newspapers, did a story that said, the new eco beat. Before Earth Day, there were only about 4 or 5 newspapers that had a regular reporter assigned to writing about environmental issues. By the end of the summer after Earth Day, it was 100. That was not ephemeral. It continued. By 1973, it was well more than 100. That was a permanent change, that the media realized they had to cover environmental issues on a regular basis. Publishers, same thing. A year after Earth Day, a librarian at the Library of Congress said more books had been published since Earth Day than ever before in American history, which is an exaggeration. But it was acknowledging this new phenomenon, eco-publishing. Publishers realized people wanted to learn about these issues. There were new courses for new environmental studies programs that were created at colleges. There were how-to books for individuals who wanted to reduce their environmental impact. And there were a variety of other institutional legacies that were apparent pretty quickly. Many of the organizing groups stayed in business after Earth Day. They didn't just fold up after the successful event. They became city and state groups, and some of them created the first recycling programs in their area. Some of them became lobbying organizations. Some of them founded local ecology centers. So this new infrastructure came directly out of Earth Day, it was clear within 6 months or a year that there were going to be lasting institutional legacies, although no one put all the pieces together. No one wrote a story a year later that said, oh, my God, look at all the things that have happened since Earth Day.
Was there concern that the movement could sustain that level of energy and that level of engagement continuously?
I think because there had been no movement before, I think people were just mostly they were thrilled. I mean, even the idea of whether there would be another Earth Day, Nelson didn't foresee that there would be when he had the idea initially. It was so successful, he decided, let's try it again. But he knew it wouldn't be the same kind of thing. He wanted Earth Day itself afterward to be an occasion for the media to have an annual stock taking, what progress had we made, for students to be able to do that, for politicians. And the next Earth Day was a disappointment, even probably by that standard. But I think that people, so many people came out of Earth Day energized and wanting to make a difference. And they were so jazzed up and just working so hard. I don't think they stopped to think about how many others were doing it. It was just clear that they were able to do incredible things, especially young people. Because this was all new, young people could really create opportunities for themselves to work on these issues. And so I think that was so exciting for so many people that they didn't really stop to think, is this sustainable? They just were sustaining it themselves, and collectively, in fact, that added up to something quite sustainable.
Adam Rome, the book is The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970s Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Adam, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a great pleasure, Jeff. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.